Okay, so in this class we're going to do things a little bit differently because I'm going to start with next month's elections, general elections in Britain, where David Cameron, the Prime Minister, is hoping to keep his job, of course, and the Labour leader, Ed Miliband, is hoping to get a new job as Prime Minister. And I go to work back from there because over the last few weeks, I've sometimes looked at social history or cultural history, but quite a lot of what we've been doing has been political history. The important governments, the big reforms of 45, of the 1960s, of Thatcherism and so on. And in particular, I've been explaining the importance of the two big parties, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, and I've been careful to explain, I think, that inside the Conservative Party you have different opinions, and inside the Labour Party you also have different opinions, but also that there's been a general development with the coming of the crisis, and that I defined Thatcherism as the conservatism of the crisis, and New Labour as the Labourism of the crisis. And I think that's generally true. I spent a lot of time on the Conservative and the Labour parties because these two parties have been historically very stable. In France, as you know, you got the RPR, qui est devenu UMP, qui va devenir, ils vont changer de nom à nouveau. Yeah? So the very, very unstable situation. And also in France, you have the situation of a powerful communist party getting smaller and smaller, since 1945. Whereas in Britain, you've had a pretty stable Labour and Conservative. Yeah? And the parties have changed, but they've been very influential. So, they've changed, but they've remained very influential. So, we're going to have the elections in May 2015. The elections will be on a Thursday, because they're always on a Thursday. They're always on a Thursday. Why are they always on a Thursday? It's an interesting question. I don't know, but I have some ideas. I think that the first reason is you cannot make English people leave their homes on a Sunday. Okay, it's Sunday, we're staying at home, yeah, so that nobody thinks it would be a good idea to have them on a Sunday. This is also why we don't have Sunday morning markets. In France, the Sunday morning markets is an important institution. In England, we don't have them on a Sunday. I think the second reason may be that traditionally you received your wages on a Thursday. For many, not today, now most people receive their wages every month now, but for a long time, until the 1970s, people would receive their wages, often in cash, on a Thursday. And so, of course, if you've just received your wages, you're happier than the previous day, and so the government likes you to organise the elections on a Thursday. In any case, it's always on a Thursday. School children are very happy, because, they've closed my school because it's being used for the elections. Yeah, so it's very, very popular from that point of view. The last time we had the elections was then 2010, and David Cameron was successful. However, it was a very, very unusual result the last time. Extremely unusual results, because the result was a coalition government between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. The Liberal Democrats, then the third party in Britain, they've never had 100 members of parliament, for example. I don't know how many they have now, maybe 30, 40, maybe 50. So it's never been a massive party, but they've been a third party, and I think it's fair to say that they are somewhere in the middle of the Conservatives and the Labour parties. Je ne sais pas si vous connaissez bien la situation en France, mais les centristes autour de Raymond Barre, il y a 10 ans, c'était un peu ça. Okay, so the Liberal Democrats. A very unusual result then 5 years ago, very unusual result, a coalition. We don't have coalitions in Britain. In Italy, they have them all the time. In Spain, they have them quite frequently. Even in France, it's quite. In Britain, we only normally have coalitions when there's a war on, the Second World War. Yeah, and there's a reason for this, and that is that the electoral system favours big parties. So I have to do a little parenthesis here on the electoral system. Now, I know you have had this explained to you before, but I would just explain it briefly again. The first-past-the-post system is the traditional electoral system in Britain, and it's a very simple idea. On dit en français le scrutin uninominal à un seul tour. Okay, the first-past-the-post system. Yeah, you knew that, didn't you? I'm sure you did. It's very simple. So if you live in Manchester and your Member of Parliament is for Manchester North, you have the election on a Thursday and you count the votes, and the member with the most votes has won. Now, in theory, they could have only 10%. In theory, the winner has 10%. And the losers have 9%, 9%, 9%, 9%, 9%. That's in theory, that's possible. So it's just a very, very straightforward thing. Now, I don't know if you are mathematicians, but one of the results is it's very difficult to be the third party. Let's imagine you establish a new party to support John Mullen. And we have 5% in every town in the country. We will have zero members of parliament. If we have 10%... in every town in the country, zero members of parliament. If we have 20%, 30%, imagine we have 35%, 40% in every town in the country, zero members of parliament. You must have more than 50% in one town to have one member of parliament. Yeah. So this is a... There have been many, many long debates about if this is a good thing or if this is a bad thing. The people who criticise this system say it's not fair. The small parties, they have 10%, they have 20%, they have no members of parliament, it's not fair. And the defenders of the system say, well, it has advantages. First of all, we don't have coalition governments, which some people consider to be an advantage, because it allows governments to be take a clearer orientation. And there's a second reason, and that is that in England, in Britain, the idea of voting for an individual person is very important. And it's not so unusual to hear people say, I'm a Conservative, but I vote Labour because in Manchester North, the Labour Member of Parliament is very good. That is, I vote for somebody from another party because of their individual characteristics. In any case, that was the first-past-the-post system has been the system for 100 years, 150 years, yeah? Through the 19th century, the big reforms of 1867, 1884, the big reforms of 1918 and 1928, more people could vote, the first-past-the-post system. However, today it is under pressure. There has been no change for national general elections. There's no change. It's still this system. But for some other elections, they have changed the system. For example, the European elections are done by a complicated system, which includes voting for a party and not for an individual. In Scotland, the Scottish elections are organised on a hybrid system, where you vote for some members of parliament as individuals and then some members of parliament by a slate system and system list. So there is more recognition today that maybe this traditional system is not sufficient. Okay, so to go back to the election of 5 years ago, what the result was that at the end of the election day, no party had 51% of the seats in Parliament. So that was a problem, yeah? That was a problem, yeah? So the Labour, I can't remember the exact numbers, the Labour Party counted their seats, and they said, oh dear, we don't have a majority. Yeah, we don't have 51%. And of course, it's very, very difficult to be the government if you don't have 51%, because when you propose a law, you can lose. And the Conservative Party, in the same way, did not have 50%. And so, what did they do? What are the options? Well, everybody was looking for a coalition. That was the seemed to be the only. There were three options. The Conservative Party finds some allies to make a government, or the Labour Party finds some allies to make a government, or you organise another general election immediately. And those are the three options. And in fact, what happened was that the the Labour Party negotiated for a while with the Liberal Democrats, because the Liberal Democrats had several dozen members of Parliament. And the negotiations were not successful. And then the Conservative Party negotiated with the Liberal Democrats, and they formed a coalition government. Nick Clegg became Deputy Prime Minister. David Cameron became Prime Minister, and Nick Clegg became Deputy Prime Minister from the Liberal Democrats. Now, this was politically rather surprising, because the Liberal Democrats had, this is 5 years ago, the Liberal Democrats had organised an election campaign mostly critical of the Conservatives. That is, that when you read what the Liberal Democrats wrote during the election campaign, they said it's dangerous to vote Conservative. The worst thing is the Conservatives. And so it seemed logical that many of the members of the Liberal Democrats and the voters of the Liberal Democrats thought, oh, well, they might make a coalition with the Labour Party, I suppose. And so this decision to make a coalition with David Cameron was badly seen by a lot of people. And in fact, the support for the Liberal Democrats is around 20 number of votes, not number of members of Parliament, is around 28-29% until the last election. And then it goes down, in 2 weeks, it goes down to 5. Because most of the people who support the Liberal Democrats were supporting the Liberal Democrats against the Conservatives. And so this coalition was very controversial. And Nick Clegg became extremely unpopular. In some ways more unpopular than leaders like Margaret Thatcher or Tony Blair. One of the symbolic questions was the question of tuition fees. Now, sometimes, this is about university tuition fees. Sometimes in the French newspapers they say frais d'inscription, because you pay frais d'inscription. In fact, literally, c'est frais de formation. C'est-à-dire que vous payez les salaires des enseignants. Today, in Britain, if you go to university, you have to pay 11,000 euros every year. Okay, je te dis en euros pour vous aider, £9,000 a year. So, here is the problem. Before the last elections, 6 years ago, you had to pay £3,000 a year. And the Liberal Democrats said, this is terrible, £3,000 a year, it's terrible, and I promise, if I am elected, I will. Nick Clegg said, I promise if I am elected, I will never support the increase of tuition fees. And he appeared on television signing a paper, I promise, sign Nick Clegg. Yeah? Photographs. Then he joined the Conservative government, and the tuition fees went from 3,000 to 9,000, and Nick Clegg voted in favour. Now, although many people are a little cynical about politicians and sometimes not surprised when politicians promise something and then do something else, this appeared to be a very extreme case. I am on television, I promise, I sign Nick Clegg, and then 3 months later, or 5 months later, he supported the multiplying by three. So he did become very, very unpopular. And in fact, you saw him on radio programs. There's a radio program called Desert Island Discs, which is about your life. And it's an extremely polite and gentle program where they say, oh, tell me about your life and your childhood and how you became who you are. And Nick Clegg appeared on this, and the presenter said, oh, you're Nick Clegg. You tell lies, don't you? Yeah. You say, vous êtes un menteur, n'est-ce pas? Yeah. So an extremely aggressive attack on a nostalgic program. This was just a symbol that Nick Clegg was really tremendously unpopular. So that's what happened last time. So we're arriving this time, here we have the first article, which I'm going to read to you. This is an article from The Economist. About the situation in Britain today with the elections coming up. And so I'm going to read it to you, and then I'm going to explain some of the references. I'm not doing a commentaire de texte. However, it's important to know who is writing, The Economist is a very conservative magazine, but also a magazine which wants to give the facts in detail. You know, you can learn a lot from The Economist because it's an international magazine which sells all over the world, mostly to businessmen and to administrators. And so it's a very serious magazine. If they give some facts, they will be true. It's a very, very serious magazine, even though their opinion is always conservative. Electoral arithmetic, it ain't got that swing. Why this election is exceptionally hard to predict. No British election is complete without a swingometer. The classic version looks a bit like the bottom half of a clock with the hour hand showing the national swing from one of the main parties to the other and indicating how many seats will change hands as a result. It first appeared on the BBC's report on the 1959 general election as a hand-operated dial on a black and white map of Britain. These days it is snazzier with digital animations, but in May it will be almost completely irrelevant. Though the fundamental mathematics of the election are unchanged, to win an outright majority, a party needs about 320 seats, the notion of a national swing has been thrown out. As a result, predicting the outcome of the election is even harder than usual. Yes, so this is a particularly exciting election because we don't know what's going to happen. Well, usually you kind of know what's going to happen. Why is this? Let's look at the next paragraph. The rise of the smaller parties is the most important explanation. In 2010, the Conservative, Labour and Liberal Democrat parties carved up most of Britain, though not Northern Ireland, between them. UKIP, the Scottish National Party and the Green Party won just 6% of votes together. But some recent polls have suggested that those three could scoop as much as a quarter of the popular vote this time. Although only the SNP's voters are concentrated enough to carry many parliamentary seats, the Greens and UKIP's could skew the results in dozens of constituencies. In some places, they will split the Labour vote. In others, the Tory one. In still others, they could help to bring down a Liberal Democrat. So the old assumption that elections are decided by the direct exchange of votes between the two main parties no longer holds. So the first reason it's difficult to predict the elections is the rise of the smaller parties. Let's continue. A second change is the regionalisation of British politics. In the post-war decades, the country swayed fairly uniformly, like a pendulum, between the new two main parties. Now different regions have different political dynamics. Labour emerged from the 2010 election as the party of the North and the big cities. The Conservatives as that of the South and rural areas. See map, we will look at the map in a moment. The North-South economic divide reinforces this. For example, in this election, Lib Dem MPs will probably fare worst in leftish parts of the North, where the coalition's public spending cuts were deepest than in the more prosperous South. Another big shift is that MPs are becoming more independent. The internet makes it easier for them to develop personal brands, and the public's disillusionment with politics encourages them to behave like outsiders. Many in Westminster mention Gisela Stewart, a Labour MP, as the example to follow. Her Birmingham Edgbaston seat should have gone Tory in 2010, but she held it by campaigning energetically on local issues and by being conspicuously independent-minded. If more MPs are acting like her, and it seems they are, the outgoing Parliament was the most rebellious since at least 1945, the national swing will be even less relevant. All of this explains why it is fiendishly hard to tell which way the election will go. With so many cross-cutting questions, will UKIP gift Tory seats to Labour? How will the Lib Dems hold up in the South? Will more local champion MPs hang on to seats that they would otherwise lose? It might be past breakfast time on May the 8th, Friday the May the 8th, before the result is clear. But that is chiefly a problem for sophologists. Sophologists are experts in elections. The problem for politicians is that forming a government after the election might prove complicated. Geographically polarised, hemmed in by insurgents, and only partly in control of their MPs, neither Labour nor the Conservatives have a commanding lead. If that does not change in the next few weeks, Britain might end up with another hung parliament. A hung parliament is the technical term for a parliament where no party has more than half the seats. That's a hung parliament. It doesn't mean that they hang them. The question then becomes, what combination of parties' MPs would add up to more than 320? At first glance, Labour has most reasons to be chipper, to be cheerful. Its votes are more efficiently distributed than those of the Conservatives. So, under Britain's first-past-the-post electoral system, it gets more seats for less support. Fully 36% of the vote put the Tories 20 seats short of a majority in 2010. 35% gave Labour a majority of 64 in 2005. And Labour might be able to team up with two hefty partners, the Lib Dems and the Scottish National Party. The Tories have only the Lib Dems. Yet, the Tories have the momentum. Since last summer, David Cameron's party has erased a 10-point Labour lead. As this briefing went to press, Elections Etc. and Electoral Forecast, two websites run by political scientists, respectively projected that it will emerge, the Conservatives will emerge, with 296 and 283 seats, with Labour on 261 and 280. Anything much above that should put another Tory Lib Dem government, possibly with the support of Northern Irish Unionists, within reach. Nick Clegg, the Lib Dem leader, would probably prefer to deal with David Cameron than with Ed Miliband. It is also possible that the next government will not have a majority at all, particularly if the Lib Dems are too small to prop up either of the main parties. Thus, a weak minority government would emerge, probably getting little done, but possibly wobbling on for a surprisingly long time. The Fixed Term Parliaments Act, introduced in 2011, means an election could only be called before 2020 if two-thirds of MPs agree to it, or one government is voted out and another is not in place after 2 weeks. And MPs will not only support an early, MPs will only support an early dissolution of Parliament if they have a good sense of any election result, which, to judge how unpredictable British politics is these days, they will not. Okay, so there's a lot of information in there. Some of it's easy to understand, some of it's not so easy to understand. And it tells you a lot about British politics. So the first thing is right at the end, the 2011 Fixed Parliaments Act. Because for many years, for 100 years, when did you have elections in Britain? When the Prime Minister decided that it was possible to have an election any time the Prime Minister thought it was a good idea. Now, of course, in theory, technically, they have to go and see the Queen. Hello, Madam Queen, can I have an election? But she always says yes, so that's okay. This was quite important. Because although, of course, politics is politics, it also is influenced by many other things as well. Imagine if Tony Blair had been in power for 3 years before the death of Lady Diana. 3 months after the death of Lady Diana was a good moment to call an election, because Tony Blair was very popular for reasons which were about how he dealt with the death of one person, that not really political reasons, in a way. Another example, when Britain won the World Cup in 1966, the next election was won easily by Labour. The government become more popular when popular things happen, even if they are football and things like that. Now, this is only 3 or 4% different, but 3 or 4% is a lot in politics. So this is no longer possible under the new law. Surprising change. Elections are always 5 years after the previous one. Always 5 years, except if you can get 2/3 of the MPs. That's almost impossible, to get 2/3 of the MPs. That is to say, if both of the big parties think it's a good time for an election, Now, that's not very likely, is it? Because everybody wants an election when they have a good chance. Now, that's an interesting new law, and also it goes into something which I've already noted, that from 1928 till 1997, very, very little constitutional change. Very, very slow changes, a reform of the House of Lords in 1958, but otherwise almost nothing. And once Tony Blair began, a lot of constitutional changes, the Supreme Court, the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Parliament, the Northern Irish Parliament, this is under the Conservatives, the Fixed Term Parliaments Act. So we're in a situation where the British Constitution, which everybody imagined never changes, in fact, in the last 20 years, there's actually quite a lot of changing things. So, you know, maybe we will get rid of the monarchy yet. You never know. Your luck. Okay, so I will come back to some of these in a moment, but I want you to have a look at the map at the bottom. And it's very, very interesting map is this, because in fact each little hexagon represents one parliamentary constituency. Une circonscription parlementaire. And so you can see that on this map on the left, Scotland is very, very small. That's because Scotland is big, but there are not a lot of people. So one parliamentary constituency takes up a lot of area. So here you have the real map on the right, the geographical map. And on the left you have the map by constituency. And that reminds you that from a point of view of population, Scotland is not so important. And Northern Ireland also is not so important. And the very what do you notice when you look at Scotland on this map here? Scotland on this map here, on the big map. Yeah?
The major party that would be elected would be Labour.
Yes, that's right. How many Conservative members of Parliament are there in Scotland? Could you find them, the blue ones? One. In Scotland, people who don't like the Conservatives in Scotland say, in Scotland we have more pandas than Conservative members of Parliament, because there are two giant pandas in Edinburgh Zoo, and only one. This is very British humour, yeah, they have more giant pandas. And in fact, the Scottish National Party, when David Cameron, or one of his friends, came to Scotland, the Scottish National Party all dressed as pandas to do a demonstration to mock David Cameron. Said, yeah, we don't want him to feel all alone. Now, this is very good modern politics. It's got showbiz in it. I quite like that. Okay, so the first thing is you can perhaps see why Scotland, the Scottish, can be rather unhappy with the system. Because before, this was all very, very similar before 1997, and when there was no Scottish Parliament, all of the decisions were taken in London by a Conservative government, and there were no Conservative MPs in Scotland, and this was one of the reasons why the referendum of 1997 saying, do you want a Scottish Parliament? This came after 18 years of Conservative government from London. Yeah, so this is one of the reasons, yes, that is to say that the popularity of first of all, a Scottish Parliament, and secondly, the relative popularity of Scottish independence is not only about nationalism. It's also about a feeling that In fact, you sometimes hear people say, you know, I'm not a nationalist, but I want independence. Yeah? Because the government in London is Conservative, and in Scotland we're not. Well, of course, there are Conservatives in Scotland, but they don't tend to win elections. So, also, if you look at the rest of England, to the most important part, which is England, you can see that it is very much regionalised, as the article mentions. Look at the north is red, and London is red. And Wales is red, and all the rest is blue. Yeah, it's very, very simply put together. So much more regionalised than France, for example, which is more complicated. Yeah. So this is obviously going to be a source for some tension. So what do they say in this article? Well, in the first part they say that the smaller parties are getting much bigger, and they mention some of them. The Scottish National Party, let me say a little bit about each one. The Scottish National Party first. The Scottish National Party was founded in the 1920s. And the name of the Scottish National Party is not an accident. They founded it in the 1920s. And they decided to call it the Scottish National Party and not the Scottish Nationalist Party. That's not an accident. That's because they wanted inside the same party people who want independence and people who want more autonomy for Scotland but not independence. To understand this, you have to be very clear on the difference between devolution, autonomy and independence. What we have today is autonomy, an autonomous parliament in Scotland, who are allowed to decide a lot of things, health, education, transport, tourism, but are not independent, because if you're independent, you can decide everything. Yeah? And as you know, so the Scottish National Party had many ups and downs. One of the things to be noticed is that there was not a military wing. One might consider this to be quite surprising. In Ireland, as you know, the people who wanted unity for Ireland and independence for Ireland had political activities and also military activities. Whereas in Scotland, that was not the case. Yeah, there's not been a Scottish military section. Even in Wales, there was a small military independence group, very, very small. Yeah. So that's one thing. It has always been a constitutional campaign, but it's always been going up and down. And in particular, I can't give you the whole history, but in 1979, they had a very bad time. Just before Thatcher was elected, there was a referendum, which was mentioned by your classmates just a moment ago, it was not successful. There were not enough voters to establish a Scottish Parliament. And then Margaret Thatcher won the election, and Margaret Thatcher was completely opposed to all forms of independence or autonomy in Scotland. In 1982 or 1983, it looked like Scottish nationalism was dead. It was a very, very bad time to be a Scottish nationalist. How many years is that ago? 30 years ago. 32 years ago. I remember it well. 32 years ago. And today, well, last year there was a referendum, as you know, on independence. And, okay, the people who wanted independence did not win. But they got, 43%? Yeah, 43% of the Scottish population, something like that. Voted for independence. So the Scottish National Party today are major important players in British politics. So it just goes to show you get this enormous range of things. Now the referendum then decided last September not to have independence, but it was close, and the British government was panicking. In the last few weeks, it was really quite poetic to see them panic. For example, suddenly, for the first time ever, David Cameron had a Scottish flag on top of 10 Downing Street. This is problematic. It's always risky, of course, to show Scotland is important to me. Please do not vote for independence because Scotland is important to me. Now, this is always risky in politics, yeah, because people in Scotland might think, oh, Scotland is important to him, that's good, maybe I won't vote for independence. Or they might think, me, Isamok Tequila, yeah, for the first time in 10 years he's put up a... Yeah, so, yeah, politics is dangerous, yeah, you do something for one reason, but it doesn't always work that way. They certainly panicked. In fact, one day they cancelled the day in Parliament, and the leader of the Conservative Party and the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats all went to Scotland for the day to campaign against independence. So it was pretty close. And the other thing was, just before the referendum, two weeks before, the Conservative government, David Cameron, said, oh, we promise much more autonomy for Scotland. If you vote against independence, we will give more power to the Scottish Parliament. Of course, the idea is to tell the Scottish it's not necessary to vote for independence because Edinburgh will have enough power without voting for independence. But again, this is a big danger. You see, if you give any group this much, you say, oh, if I give them this much, they will be satisfied. That's always a little dangerous in politics, because you can encourage them to go further. And in any case, the referendum campaign was very interesting, and I think it's fair to say, at least it's my opinion, that the Scottish National Party, although they lost the referendum, they were successful in persuading the population in general that the independence of Scotland was possible, that it was a realistic option. They gave a lot of information. Let's compare with other countries with similar populations. Denmark. Oh, Denmark is quite successful. Small countries. Whereas 10 years ago, when people said Scottish independence, it appeared to be a completely impossible dream. It was just ridiculous. I think the Scottish National Party had some success. And we will see in a moment that the leader of the Scottish Nationalists, souvent dit Scottish Nationalists, même si en principe on devrait dire Scottish National Party, the leader of the Scottish National Party, Nicola Sturgeon, is being very visible, and in fact, just a few days ago, there was a television debate in Britain between all the main leaders of the main parties. Seven people in the room debating about the election. This shows something else about the British elections, and that is that the kind of campaigning has changed. The traditional way of campaigning in Britain, I think I already mentioned to you, is to go to the door, knock on the door. Ah, good morning. I'm from the Labour Party. Can I count on your votes? Did I tell you this? Yes, I was. That's the traditional way. Of course, today, first of all, the internet, etc., is much more important. Because I need information about the elections for my classes, I signed up to the Labour Party website, and they say every 2 days they send me an email. And they're very modern emails. You know, it's, you know, just one question. You know, what do you think about this? Click here to say you agree. Click here to say you disagree. Yeah, and then you click and you agree, and there's a nice cartoon saying how, you know, it's very modern, if you like. Yeah, I recommend it. It's quite, and I'm sure the Conservatives also have become much more modern. So the image, and of course television is also becoming more important. And in particular, television debates. There was no tradition in Britain of television debates. Harold Wilson did not debate on television with the Macmillan. Callaghan and Heath did not debate on television. It was considered to be a kind of a bit of an American way of doing things. But in the last few years, there has been a rise of TV debates. For good or for bad. David Cameron didn't want really this debate. And so he didn't want to debate with Ed Miliband, the Labour leader. And so he insisted, he said, I will only debate if we also have the Greens. Now, it's not because he loves the Greens, but he felt that he would be better in a bigger group. And so finally they had seven, I'm not even sure I can remember them all, last week that they had a debate with seven people, the Conservative leader, David Cameron, the Labour leader, Ed Miliband, the Liberal Democrats leader, Nick Clegg, the Green leader, Natalie Bennett, the Scottish National Party leader, Nicola Sturgeon, the UKIP leader, I will talk about them in a moment, Nigel Farage, and I imagine that the last one was the Northern Ireland Party. I'm sure it must be. So I found seven. I'm proud of myself. So that's a rather unusual configuration. It's seven leaders. It can appear to be a bit confusing, yeah. So that's one of the things that's going on, and also that reflects, of course, the importance of the smaller parties, which were mentioned here. I need to say a little bit about UKIP because they have a certain importance, not so much not just in this election. Does anybody know what UKIP stands for? United Kingdom, yes. Independence Party. The United Kingdom Independence Party. And they are led by a man. I almost said a gentleman, but a man called Nigel Farage. Let's see if you can imagine. UKIP, who do you imagine is their main enemy? Two main enemies. For a name with a party like that. For a party with a name like that. One, Europe, yes. Good, thank you. Number two? Immigrants. All immigrants. Okay, so it's an anti-immigrant party and an anti-European party. When it began, people didn't take it very seriously, but now they're getting a lot of support. I mean, like 20% support in large parts of the country. UKIP is not a fascist organisation. There is a history of fascist organisations in Britain, like in France. In the 1970s, the National Front had a certain influence. They got a few people elected in local councils. There was a big campaign against them, the Anti-Nazi League, in my opinion, quite successfully, and the National Front's decline through the 1980s. They were replaced by another fascist group, the British National Party, in the 1990s, which had a few people elected at local level. But again, that the anti-fascist movement was very strong, and let's say that the traditional fascists, people who like Jean-Marie Le Pen, have a particular relationship with fascism from the 1930s, they were not successful in Britain in stabilising an organisation which could win elections. And so UKIP is something which is very right-wing, but which is not a fascist organisation. Although they are having problems at the moment, because of course their official line is, we are not racist, of course, that's the official line, but many of their candidates are interviewed and say things which show that, you know, they really are. So the UKIP is having to be taken seriously because quite high levels of support, 15-20%, you know, that sort of support, quite serious support. So that's another small party. Of course, this is important, not so much for the number of MPs, because as you know, as I mentioned, if you have 15% in every town, you get zero MPs. However, it makes a difference because the UKIP will often take votes from the Conservatives and allow Labour to win in a town. Just like the Scottish National Party will sometimes take votes from Labour. Third small party, the Greens. Green support is around 7, 8, 9% in Britain. And again, this is they have the problem of small parties in Britain. That is to say that if you have 8% in every town, you get zero MPs. However, the Greens have one MP. Greens have one MP, which is but they have quite a lot of influence, because also locally, of course, if you are the Green Party in Manchester, you can discuss with Labour and you can say, we will support you if you do these ecological things. Yeah, we have a lot of supporters. So they have some. Interestingly enough, their leader is Australian. She's lived in England for 15 years, but she's Australian. Okay, what else could I say about this article? Well, it's very typical British article in that if you look at the title, ain't got that swing. You have a pun, un jeu de mots, because of course it's saying that the swing between Labour and Conservative is not important anymore. But also, it's actually a song. Yeah, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. It's a blues song. And if you look at the map, the heading of the map is Tangled Up in Blue, which is a song by Bob Dylan. Now, this is very British. The British newspapers, they like to have amusing headings. There are always jokes somewhere, little jokes. This is a serious newspaper, and it's a serious article about a serious subject, and there are always jokes, because that is British culture. It's obligatory. Right, so the rise of the smaller parties. The rise of the smaller parties, the regionalisation of politics, and the fact that members of parliaments are becoming more independent, that sometimes the Labour leader discovers that some of his members are not being so obedient. You see this a little bit in France with the député, comment on dit ça en français, le frondeur, so the Socialist Party MPs who are not following their leadership. And there's an interesting point in this article because they said, notice that with the internet, it's easier to be independent. Because if you are a Labour member of Parliament, you can have your own website with your own opinions. Yeah, you don't only have the official opinions of the Labour Party. You can build a personal following much more easily than you could before the internet. Because I remember doing politics before the internet. You take the envelope, you write an address on it, you put the leaflet in the envelope, you lick the envelope, you put a stamp on it, and you send it. And that's like, you know, that's like sending a Facebook message to one person. Then you do it again for a second person. You know, it takes a long time. Okay. And at the end of the article, they try to speculate a little bit, and they say that the situation appears to be better for the Labour Party. Because if Labour work with the Scottish National Party, that should be enough to make a majority. Or if Labour work with the Liberal Democrats, that should be enough to form a majority. However, the Conservatives cannot work with the Scottish National Party because the Conservatives have been absolutely opposed to devolution, to an autonomous party in Scotland. And of course, because in Scotland there is only one Conservative MP, then the Scottish National Party leader cannot say, oh, we're going to have a coalition with the Conservatives. She would probably be shot by one of her friends or something like that. I'm exaggerating, but it's politically impossible. Okay, so let's have a look at her a little more, because I have a second article for you here about this young lady. Oh, no, it's one for me and lots for you, not the other way around. I'm going to start reading it as it comes round. So first of all, if you look at the picture at the top, you can see this leader. And what do you notice about her as the leader of a political party? What do you notice about her? Anything surprising about her? Yeah? Say again? She's playing music. That's surprising. There are other surprising things about her as the leader of a political party. Does she look like the leaders of the political parties in France today? That's right. Let's get more basic than this. It's a woman. That's number one. That's it. There are no, you know, who are the leaders of the political parties in France? François Hollande. She's a woman leader, okay? And something else. Yes, she does wear red. That is important. But let's stick with more basic things. How old is she? Yeah, about 14. Yes, that's correct. No, she's not. Of course, she's not 14, but she looks about 14. Yeah. So she certainly does not look like François Hollande or Nicolas Sarkozy. But Nicolas Sarkozy is quite young compared with the others. Alain Juppé. Okay, so this is showing something. So this is a party, the Scottish National Party. This is interesting because we often imagine Scottish people as rather traditional in questions of men and women. Let's look at the image. And they have a young woman leader. Okay, so that's something new. And actually, you're absolutely right, she's wearing red. Why is she wearing red? Why is she wearing red? Why are you not wearing red?
Maybe she wants to promote modernity.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. She's looking modern and dynamic, yeah? Yeah, if you're a small party, you have to be very visible. It's true. It's nothing very complicated there. And of course, there she is, also being shown in a very modern context, conducting music with. Of course, this is a little joke by The Economist, as usual. Okay, so let's see what they're going to be saying about this. Well, first of all, at the top right, you have. The other articles, which I'm not showing you, in this is a special section of The Economist about the elections, and you can see that they have written an article about taxes and the election. Electoral quotes of the week, les citations de la semaine. The demise of small GP surgeries. A GP, what is a GP? A doctor. A doctor. Dans la désertification médicale, on dirait en français. Youth unemployment. The gay votes. And Britain's skills shortages. Okay, so this is important, this section here, because this tells you what the economist thinks are the most important questions of this election. Obviously, youth unemployment, le chômage des jeunes. Yeah, on a l'habitude que chaque élection, ça a quand même une certaine importance, hein, heureusement. The question of the health service is very present in this election campaign, and this particular example is it's difficult to get doctors in many towns. Okay. Skills shortages, that's more of a business operation. So oui, le manque de compétences dans la force de travail en Angleterre. So this is going to be, no doubt, critical of British universities, etc., you know, saying they're not doing their job correctly. And the gay votes, I haven't yet read that one, but this is an important question because something very, very surprising happened 3 years ago, and that is that a Conservative government in Britain voted for gay marriage, introduced a law to mean that it is now possible in Britain, like in France, for people to marry whatever, whoever they want, and not only somebody of the opposite sex. Now, politically, I'm trying to imagine, let's go back 25 years, and you say to somebody, in 2012, a Conservative government will introduce a law to make it possible for gay people to marry each other. People would think you were completely crazy. C'était absolument impossible. Ça semblait absolument impossible. So that's what it, now in France the same has happened, but it wasn't a Conservative government, you know. So something very, very surprising going on there. So perhaps that's what they're talking about there. Okay, so let's see if I can get a little bit started on this before the end. Nicola Sturgeon, there she is, calling the tune. The Scottish National Party's canny leader could yet break up the United Kingdom. That is, that they're saying that although the referendum on independence was negative, that they did not break up the United Kingdom, it might still happen. According to Google, the most searched for phrase halfway through Britain's televised election debate on April the 2nd was Nicola Sturgeon, the combative chief of the separatist Scottish National Party. Though unfamiliar to many English voters, was making light work of the leaders of their main political parties. By the end, "Can I vote for the SNP?" was also trending, further evidence that she has impressed many south of the border. So, has Miss Sturgeon any plans to put forward candidates in England? Despite the temptations and encouragement, no, she says, seated in a box room at the SNP's functional headquarters. Okay, so they're underlining she's seated in a box room. A box room, c'est un placard au fond. Yeah. So they're underlining the fact that the Scottish National Party doesn't have any money. Yeah, they're just very, very small things. Not even to mark the 700th anniversary of the Siege of Carlisle in 1315, a famous Scottish assault on the English border city, the normally rather flinty leader emits a sound which is almost a giggle. Don't tempt me. Don't tempt me. I can't do a Scottish accent. On the shelves behind her are mementos of the SNP's remarkable rise from an irrelevant party in the 1960s to one that may soon be Britain's third biggest, and her own remarkable rise. "She's got Scotland's oil," reads an old SNP advert depicting Margaret Thatcher as a vampire, the black stuff dripping from her teeth. It is a reminder of what Ms Sturgeon calls the disgust at what the Thatcher-led Tory government was doing that first recruited her to the party. Everywhere, leering from books and photos, is also the image of Alex Salmond, the former leader of the SNP, with whom Ms Sturgeon has had a somewhat vexed relationship sometimes. She was expected to become leader in 2004 after Mr Salmond's first crack at the job, then he suddenly fancied another go at it and shunted her aside. Ms Sturgeon, who grew up in a working-class family near Ayr on Scotland's west coast, then served as his deputy for a decade. She got her chance after Mr. Salmond again stepped down last September, having led Scotland closer to independence at the referendum held that month than even the SNP had previously considered possible. And that dream is not dead. Miss Sturgeon has presided over an astonishing surge in support for the party, making her Britain's most powerful female politician. Nothing about the SNP's recent rise, including the brush with national dismemberment it occasioned last year, was inevitable. It was chiefly a product, in the opinion of The Economist, of its leaders' passion and cunning. That is how, back in 2011, the SNP won a shock majority in the Scottish Parliament under an electoral system designed to preclude this, which triggered the referendum. By building a sprawling army of activists, it then took the United Kingdom to the brink. The pro-union campaign won by 55% to 45%. The SNP's latest achievement is to have retained much of the activism and mass enthusiasm it worked up during the referendum campaign. Its membership has ballooned from 26,000 to over 100,000 in 6 months. People don't want to go back to the days pre-referendum when the Westminster establishment sidelined and ignored Scotland, its leader explains. SNP gatherings such as its spring conference on March the 28th, at which he was introduced as the only party leader in the UK who people actually like, resemble rock concerts. Polls suggest the party could increase its share of parliamentary seats in Westminster from 6 to over 40 at the election on May the 7th, sweeping to victory even in generations-old Labour Party strongholds like Glasgow, see chart over Leith. It may well hold the balance of power in the next British Parliament, in which no one party is likely to hold a majority. Having lost the referendum, the SNP has won its aftermath. Ms Sturgeon says she wants to use this influence to pave the way for Ed Miliband, the leader of the same Labour Party she hopes to annihilate in Scotland, to be Prime Minister. This means her MPs will oppose any Tory bid to form a government. A retort to their Labour opponents who tell left-wing Scots that a vote for the SNP helps the Conservatives. If the SNP and Labour combined have more seats than the Tories do, Ms Sturgeon insists, we can prevent David Cameron from getting back into Downing Street. Her party will even seek to do so if Labour is the second biggest party, she adds. For this assistance, she would extract a leftist price. Ms Sturgeon envisions her MPs, led by Mr. Salmond, who is standing next month for Parliament in Westminster, perhaps forcing Mr. Miliband to avoid spending cuts, opposing the renewal of Britain's nuclear deterrence, and closing the National Health Service to new private sector providers. We won't vote for Labour policies that we think are just carbon copies of Tory policies, she says. SNP involvement in the next British government, Ms. Sturgeon suggests, could form part of a process in Scotland of people gaining more confidence, of questioning why we should be at the mercy of Westminster. Okay, I'm going to stop there because I have a few things to say before the end. I think one of the things that this article shows is that the appeal of the Scottish National Party is not only about the importance of Scotland. The two things that she mentions there are, we don't want the Labour Party to privatise more parts of the National Health Service, and we don't want, the Scottish National Party, we don't want nuclear weapons. The Britain has nuclear weapon Trident submarines. These are not Scottish issues, these are national issues, which some people, perhaps a minority, across the whole of Britain find important. So the Scottish National Party in Scotland is presenting itself as a more left-wing version of Labour. It's not only concentrating on the question of Scottish identity against British identity. Now, you will find over the next few weeks a lot of articles in the British press and the French press about the elections. The elections are on the 7th of May. And no doubt you will also have France Info and FR3 giving a longer programme. So do take advantage of the upcoming election to learn some more, because they will probably talk in more detail about political issues and about people's lives and not just about politicians. Okay, thank you. That's enough for today. I will see you next week at the same time. Don't forget that you are